is December the 1st, 2006, and we are visiting with Early Hetnall. Early, you've been a big help on this project, introducing me to several different people, but I want you to start telling us about your recollections of Houston.
Well, I first came to Houston in September of 1968.
Oh, that's right.
To study art at the Art Department at Texas Southern University. And I actually rode a Greyhound bus from Hattiesburg, Mississippi, to the bus station downtown here in Houston. And then I took a cab to the campus to 3201 Wheeler Street at Lanier Hall for Men, where, you know, when I got out of the cab, I was actually carrying my little Marine Corps duffel bag and everything. And a lot of the students there was aware that students and guys was in the Marine Corps were in military service, and they were beginning to come to college. And when the guys saw me get out, they said, "Crap, don't walk on the grass." And they said, "Hey, man, let's not mess with this joker right here." And so
you were a Marine.
Yeah, because I was an ex-Marine.
Right.
And so this is my introduction to Texas. I guess you could say the first ground that I actually stepped on in Texas was at Texas Southern. Because, you know, off the Greyhound bus and then catching a taxi cab, you're still on concrete. But the actual ground that I touched was Texas Southern University.
All right, tell us how in the world you decided to come to TSU.
Well, a friend of mine named Alfred Blackwell Silsby Todd Jr., who lived in Hattiesburg, that was a high school classmate of mine, was home on academic probation. Dr. Freeman, who is the debate coach at TSU at that time, whom I did not know at the time, was the assistant dean to the College of Arts and Sciences. And students whose grades did not come up to par were expelled or sent home on academic probation for the spring semester. And I had just gotten out of the Marine Corps in January, and so it was too late for me to enroll or consider enrolling in college at that particular time. Presently, I had applied to go to the University of Southern Mississippi and to Southern University in Baton Rouge, and I had been accepted. But on a visit to Todd's house, his mother encouraged me and said, "Why don't you go to Texas?" And he said, "Yeah, man, Texas Southern has a good art department." I knew nothing of the art department at TSU, but all the way from high school, I had an inkling to want to study art. And so I did. I filled out an application, was accepted, taught, drove back to school. I caught the Greyhound bus, came to Texas, and this is how I ended up at TSU.
Well, now, when you came to TSU, did you have a sense of the area of art that you wanted to pursue?
No, I did not at that time. I knew that I was interested in art, and that I was interested in things of being creative, being a boy growing up in Mississippi, where my father, who was, I guess, an all-around kind of guy, who we kept a garden, we cut yards, he repaired the lawnmowers, he built the extension onto the house, and things of this nature. So I came from a working background, of a background where there was all kinds of experiments, you know, in our yard and in our community. So by doing and seeing, I was able to do so. To build something, to make something, or whatever, to me, it was something that came natural, and it wasn't really always a challenge, and something that I enjoyed doing. So art became a natural kind of phenomenon with me. It was a way of expressing myself, and then it was a way of using excess energy.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, who was your first instructor? Who's your first teacher?
Well, my first teacher, to be very honest, was Kermit Oliver.
Mm-hmm.
Kermit Oliver, at the time, let me go back. As an art major, as early as I can remember, and it's, we, after enrolling in the art department, all of the freshman students, I would assume it was all freshmen, or the freshmen of the art department class, our first art seminar, Dr. Biggers spoke to the students, and the statement he made that art is life. One must draw upon his experiences of family, community, and life, and things that he has experienced.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, that was quite naturally. We had to write about our family life, where he was from, and to do that in a paragraph form for him to get an understanding as to who we were, where we came from, and what we was all about.
Is this before you ever took a class?
This was in my freshman year, at the beginning of the year, during the first art seminar. I may have taken a class, enrolled in a class, but this is the early experience that I can remember. And because you asked the question, who was my first art teacher, I remember very distinctively of Kermit coming down the hall with his books under his arm and opening the door to the drawing room. And I guess it was because of his detailed kind of instruction that he presented to the class and how he, you know, his demonstration that I remember so vividly, you know, early on that way of him from that time. It was interesting because Kermit was a kind of an easygoing, speaking individual. We took a basic drawing. We had a class in elementary education along with the general university core curriculum that we had to take. See, an art major, at that time, we took what was considered a full load, about 15 hours. You know, art department was a very bustling place then at that time.
Well, when you stepped off your Greyhound bus or your taxi cab that took you over to the school and you put your big feet down on that grass, what was it like? I mean, what were your first impressions of TSU?
Well, because my coming out of the Marine Corps and traveling and coming from Vietnam, I really, you know, I had no... I can't remember being overly impressed. It was just a new environment.
Mm-hmm.
And a new environment is always challenging to you. It wasn't that it was one where I looked forward to the challenge of it. It was almost that I took it in stride as
mm-hmm.
it was presented and dealt with it from that standpoint of view. You know, we was always taught to be prepared and know where you're going. Know what you're going to do when you get there. To me, maneuvering through around TSU, that was the easiest part because there was no conflict. There wasn't anything that I was up against from that standpoint.
It was just sort of simple discovery. Uh-huh. Well, go on through and tell us how you came to be the photographer you are today.
Well, my father was an amateur photographer. And my grandmother kept a photo album of his photograph while he was in military service. And on first and third and fourth Sundays sometime, on special holidays, special occasions, he would make pictures of us, my brothers and sisters and I. I had, at the time, three brothers and two sisters. And on holidays, and we were staffed up, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6.
Mm-hmm.
And so he would make pictures of us on special occasions. And even when we got a new change of school clothing, either for Easter, certain kinds of hats and so forth and on. And my grandmother kept this photo album that she would sit on the porch during the summer and show it to us. And she would indicate certain students or people in the neighborhood and refer to the album when they were small.
This is in Hattiesburg.
In Hattiesburg, Mississippi, at Rowan High School. Our physics instructor was teaching us about chemistry and physics, and he used physics and chemistry was half of the year. One half of the year we took physics, the other half we took chemistry. He was showing us the difference between a chemical change and a physical change. And one example that he used, so negative because most people took their film to the drugstore to have them develop them,
mm-hmm.
and most people had the old type of 620 cameras that gave you the square negative,
mm-hmm.
And he used a match and a piece of paper. For the physical change, he took a match and he lit a piece of paper and it burned. For the chemical change, he took the negative, a dark room, the light box, 1001, 1002, dropped that into the developer, and then magic came forth. At that time, the seed that was planted, the idea of a boy wanting to be like his father, and the instructor in high school planting the seed of the experiment and the excitement of actually seeing an image come develop. Having that, I was hooked. And at that point, on being a photographer. And during that summer in high school, I remember going up to the community swimming pool, taking my father's camera that he purchased while he was in service in Joliet, Illinois, and making photographs. But, lo and behold, I dropped the camera into the pool.
Oh.
The lifeguard dives in and gets the camera out.
Oh.
Gives it to me. I try to dry it out. I take it home, raise up the lid to the attic, and hide it in the attic. And for some particular reason, my father never asked about it. He came home close to the end of the year when his company would give cameras to the employees as an incentive of achievement or whatever. And so he started using them for a different camera. But later on in life, he asked and we talked about it. And I told him what had happened, that I had hid the camera in the attic, the one that he had purchased during that time. So, from there, the seed of photography was basically a planted. Going and joining the Marine Corps, referring back to the time that my grandmother kept this album of my father's pictures while he was in service,
mm-hmm.
I too purchased a camera.
Mm-hmm.
My father sent me a watch, the same as he had received when he went into service. And I received a watch that I wore throughout most of Vietnam. And I purchased a small camera. And I began to make pictures of the guys that was around and our activities as best I can at the place we traveled from that standpoint of view. And what happened during that, I had a little Instamatic camera, the kind then, the little Kodak Instamatic. You can get a water log, you can check the water out, and then it would keep on working and so forth. And so this is how it started. Never knowing that I would pursue photography as a hobby, as a profession, but having that experience, it was something that came natural to me. Upon coming to TSU, it was that following June. At Texas Southern during the time, we celebrate what is in Texas is called Juneteenth.
Mm-hmm.
And what would happen, the university would purchase a load of watermelon from Hempstead and bring them to the campus, and they would have a big watermelon picnic for the students on Juneteenth. And we was out on the campus, and there was a guy named Nathaniel Smith, from East St. Louis, Illinois.
His name was Nathaniel Sweet?
S-W-E-E-T-S. And his father was a newspaper editor. And he was a photographer major. And he was going around shooting pictures. And I met him, and I said, "Hey, man, I have a camera up in my room. I made a lot of pictures while I was in Vietnam." He said, "Man, why don't you go get your camera and shoot some pictures?" And he said, "I can develop a film." And I said, "Okay." So I went up and got my camera, and I think he may have given me a roll of film, or I may have had a roll of film. And that day, I made some photographs. And Buzzy, as we call him, would develop the film in his room, and he had pet turtles and an aquarium, and he would use the water from the aquarium to cool the chemicals down. And this is my first introduction to actually developing film. And as I would go to the art department and was beginning to shoot pictures on campus, all within, I guess, a couple of weeks at that time, I discovered that there was a dark room in the art department. And one day, here comes Dr. Biggs down the hallway, dressed in a white dashiki and white pants and sandals. It was during the summertime. And I said, "Dr. Biggs." And he said, "Yeah, man." I said, "I heard there's a dark room here in the art department, and I would like to know if I could use it." He said, "Sure, man. Go right ahead." And he provided the dark room for me. Nathaniel Sweet was taking photography on campus from Mr. Evans. And I told Sweet about it, and he was excited about us being able to use the dark room. But Mr. Evans, who was a university photographer, guarded his area just like a hen guarded the hen nest. And due to the fact that there was meager kind of equipment, everything was antiquated back from the 50s and so forth, and basically outdated.
Uh-huh.
But the dark room in the art department had an enlarger, it had a modern safe light, it had trays and all of this. And so I had a problem when Nathaniel introduced me to the dark room as far as developing my film. I wasn't agitating properly. And so one day, I got the nerve to go and visit Mr. Evans, and I went there, and I knocked on the door. And he came to the door, and he kind of pulled the door to him behind him like he was guarding something, and he said, "Yes, sir, fella, can I help you?" I said, "Yes, sir, Mr. Evans." I said, "What's happening to my film?" I said, "I developed this film, and I'm getting all these spots." And he took it and looked at it, and he said, "Are you agitating?" I said, "Agitating?" He said, "Yes, you're not agitating your film." I said, "Okay." And he said, "All right." And he closed the door and went back in, because he was very short on giving an explanation.
Right.
And so from there, Nathaniel Sweet and I, during that summer, would go down to Southwestern Camera Store, which was located on Main Street,
mm-hmm.
buy a box of paper for $12, and come back, and we had an opportunity of using the dark room in the art department. And this is where I began to learn. And upon learning and experimenting there, our first painting that we had to do in the art department, we had to do something from life. And I decided to do a railroad cross tie. You know how the rails cross ties?
Sure.
So I actually made a photograph of that, developed the film, and used that as my model to do my first painting. And it had to be a three-release painting, so I used sponge and cut out sponge to make it seem like it was the rocks among the rails, and I used the plaster, and I actually built that up and so forth. And as I was beginning to make pictures, our students had to have portfolios. Then different students began to ask me, "Hey, will you make a picture for me? Will you do this for me? Will you do this?" Then the word got out across campus that there was a photographer in the art department who could shoot pictures. Then I began to shoot pictures of the young ladies, students on campus. But primarily, I remained in the art department, mainly due to the fact that the art department, the art community there at TSU at that time, we were able to work in the art department at 10 o'clock at night.
Mm-hmm.
We was able to come over there early in the morning. People would play their music. There would be people in the painting room. There would be four or five people in the ceramics room. There would be somebody in the weaving room. Almost any evening at any time, students would go back to the art department and work. There would be an instructor around, or one would be in and out. It would either be Mr. Sim, who was a potter and a sculptor, or Harry Vile. Either that would be Mr. Renfro. Somebody would be there. And there was always students there working because we can come right off the street. The door was open. You go in and work till 10:30, 11 o'clock at night.
Now, Early, describe the environment with all the students working together. Were you all mutually supportive of each other?
We was basically mutually supportive of each other because I think having the ability to create, that absorbed a lot of energy.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than finding places to go, that was at a time that integration was just began to blossom and students were begin to branch out from the campus. Most of the students at that time was living on campus and so forth, and this was still, I would assume, right after the time that Martin Luther King had been assassinated and the Kennedy assassination, you know, during that particular time. Well, that was much earlier.
2 years earlier.
Yeah,
yeah.
But still, students were in this, I guess, this new renaissance mode of working and producing. The art faculty was encouraging students to work. We was able to observe Mr. Sims throwing pots, building sculpture, John Diggers painting, coming over early in the morning. When we would get to class a lot in the morning, the art department would be open. If we would get there at 7 to 7:30, students then was enthused about coming to the art department. Mr. Sims would already be there. You walk in and you would hear classical music. You knew that Sims was down in his area. Sometimes the door would be closed, sometimes it would be open. You can walk in and Dr. Biggers would be in his studio and he would be finishing up. You know, so he would have been working. And you walk in and you would be inspired by seeing the monumental drawing that he had was working on or whatever. And then there were seminars. I remember our first seminar was a painting seminar with a man named Mr. Elton Fatt from New York, who came down and ended up giving a demonstration of a painting of a student named George Latson. And he actually ended up doing a drawing of a young lady named Beverly. I can't think of her last name. But to watch that and to actually see it take place, watch the magic of how the hand moves and how he started talking and looking at you, and he's actually drawing almost without looking at the canvas and just referring back to it. It was, you know, just like magic and so forth. And seeing that, that became a challenge. So I ended up doing a painting using the same technique.
How'd it go?
And it went well, I thought, because it was a young lady at the time that I actually was kind of infatuated about during that time. And so it worked out fine. And so the painting was a challenge. I started the painting in my freshman year before I took painting, due to the fact that Kermit and Katie Oliver always came back to the art department in the evening. They lived close to the university in a small apartment, probably smaller than the size of my studio, just this floor.
Mm-hmm.
And they would come back in the evenings to work. Kermit would come back and paint, and I had an opportunity to watch him paint. So that was motivation for the students. There was always senior students there, and there was a lot of gifted students whom you could sit down and you could talk to. Edward Mills, George Latson, they were there, and you can see what they was doing from beginning to end. So there was always that demonstration of what was taking place. And from that same point of view, it challenged you not to be lazy. It challenged you to be active. It challenged you to be responsible for what you was doing. If not, you were the person that was on the outside. If you didn't have a drawing, if you didn't have two or three paintings, if you wasn't working on something from that standpoint of view.
Well, the energy today,
mm-hmm.
similar?
Yes.
The more diffuse or what?
I still try, even with my responsibilities as a university photographer at TSU, my day still starts very early in the morning. Most mornings, I'm up at 4:30 to 5 o'clock. And I enjoy working late at night sometimes. And because I'm enthused, I look forward each and every day to picking up the camera or doing something centered around art or photography. And I think that they both go hand in hand from mm-hmm. that standpoint of view.
Mm-hmm.
And my ongoing project of documenting the community has taken place ever since the early 70s. And it's ironic that I was in school and was painting a mural in Hannah Hall, and a man walked up and said, "Are you Earthbound?" I said, "Yes, I am." He said, "Are you a photographer?" I said, "Yes, I am." He said, "Well, Mr. Evans told me that I should come and talk with you. And I need you to come to my office and talk to me and see if you would be interested in being a photographer for my cities program." I said, "Yes, sir. Well, come to room 102, Martin Luther King Center, and I'm Dr. Thomas L. Freeman." And I said, "Okay." So I went over and visited with Dr. Freeman, and he was talking real fast and was telling me that he needed pictures on Tuesdays and Thursdays of the program and all of the activities that surrounded the weekend college. And during that time, before that, let me jump back. In 1969, in the spring of 1969, Ray Carrington, who teaches photography now at Jack Yates, was a student at Texas Southern University, and he was editor of the student yearbook. And Ray was in need of some photographs. And so he sent someone to find me, probably a good friend of ours named Franklin V. Duffy. And in other words, I went over to visit Ray, and he said, "Hey, man, I need some pictures of this. I need some pictures of that." And so I brought over a stack of pictures I had been shooting. And he said, "Something broken, something fixed, something new." And he was laying out pictures. And he said, "Hey, man." Then he asked me, he said, "Well, can you do a picture? We need a picture of one of the queens." And I said, "Sure." So I took the young lady over to the art department. I had my little studio over there, the printmaking room. I was able to use that. So I made her pictures and came back. And then this is how Ray and I became friends. And all of a sudden one day, some big man walked in with a hat on his head, saying, "Hey, fella, how far are you on this yearbook?" And that was Mr. Herbert J. Provost. And Provost was the, more or less, had a contract for publishing the yearbook and providing the school pictures. So this is how I met Mr. Provost. And from that standpoint of view, this was the first indication of my being introduced to the Houston community. Visiting his studio on the corner of Dowling and Elgin, because for myself the whole first year, I doubt that I very seldom ventured off of the campus unless I rode with my homeboy Alfred Todd to go to Jack in the Box, which we ate at most nights, and then come back to the campus and so forth and on from that standpoint of view. Very seldom I spent a lot of time in the dormitory, and very seldom I went to a lot of activities that students would go to. Sometime on Saturdays and Friday nights, I would go to some of the parties, but most of the nights during the week, I was in the art department doing something from that standpoint of view. But meeting Dr. Freeman, working with Model Cities Program, which provided city services to residents within the community, in various communities, it allowed me an opportunity to have the vision of being able of viewing Houston and seeing the various neighborhoods, mm-hmm. going into the neighborhoods and shooting and making photographs. Then I was able to relate to that because Houston, being a very rural and modern city, as well as somewhat of a western city, and going back, coming to Texas, thinking that I was going to see cowboys and Indians and horses and all of these kinds of things, this was kind of a pushback, being on the university campus. But working for the Model Cities Program, the blanket was pulled back, and the real Houston was revealed to me. Fourth Ward, Fifth Ward, Trinity Garden, the Hispanic community where we photographed Denver Harvey and all of that. And Dr. Freeman's had us going around photographing the Model Cities election for officers and things of this nature, the city residents. And so this is how I actually started in the Houston community.
What happened to those photographs?
I still have a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
I have my negatives from that time.
Mm-hmm. And that was 69?
That was 70, 71, 72. During that period of time, Muhammad Ali came to Houston, and I was able to photograph him in the Houston community on the corner of Dowling and Ennis, to see him around Mr. Lord C.A. Wells, who was a sports avid and used to work for the Kansas City Chiefs. He was the first African-American scout for the Kansas City Chiefs. And Mr. Herbert Provost, who was the head tennis coach at TSU and also a photographer at that particular time. And so the relationship between the university and between the provosts and John Biggers afforded me the opportunity to begin to explore Houston from
mm-hmm.
that standpoint of view.
And then you were off and running.
And basically, I was off and running. I was more or less a self-taught photographer. Mr. Evans hired me as his student assistant. But before then, there was a guy named Alvin McEwen. This was in 1969. I was enthused about making photographs and shooting other activities on the campus. And Alvin was Mr. Evans' student assistant. He also was a member of the tennis team along with Ray. So this is how this is all tied in. Remember
mm-hmm.
now, Ray was the yearbook editor.
Mm-hmm.
Alvin was a student photographer, and Alvin and Ray both played tennis. I was an art major who had an interest in photography, along with Nathaniel Sweet, whom we called Buzzy. So we more or less all intermingled, and then we crossed over. And so I remember, it was in 1969. Alvin had said, "Hey, man, why don't you come on and go with me to the football game?" Texas Southern University was playing, Southern University. And I had a 35mm camera that I had purchased, the one I purchased in Vietnam. He came by the apartment to pick me up. And lo and behold, I picked up the camera, I picked up my bag, and pulled the camera off of the counter. It hit on the floor and splattered into my mouth.
Oh, no.
I remember that night, Alvin handed to me a Yashica Mat 124G, a 2.25 camera, and he said, you can shoot with this camera. This is how I was introduced to the medium format, the format that I love so much today. And most of the time, I carry both cameras, the 35 and the 2.25. And due to the fact that the subject appears to you and you have your choice of camera, you know, to use.
Mm-hmm.
So most times you see me carrying both of those from that standpoint of view, because the love of actually making pictures and the sensitivity of capturing motion, capturing people as they are, capturing life as it is, and being able to relate back to those experiences that I had, again, in Mississippi. As I told you, our backyard was like a laboratory. We had a garden. We sowed seeds. We had a potato bank in the fall of the year like this. I was just thinking this morning, on this cool day, that as a boy coming home in the evening out of school, about 3:30 or 4 o'clock, you know, the sun, at this time of year, the sky is so different.
Uh-huh.
And seeing it this way, in the fresh plow fields from potatoes that have been dug and harvested, we would go in and pick up the potato straps and vilify and roast potatoes, and then we would play football in the soft sod of the field. But also, there was potato banks that was built like a teepee. Potatoes were mounted up on straw, and then the corn stalk was placed over the potatoes, and then dirt was thrown up over there, and then a lean-to was there, and that kept the potatoes to hold some along. So the weather being like it is today referred back to that. Being in the fall of the year, that we would always kill a hog. And I can remember Mr. Tom would point out to us that this is the spleen, this is the kidneys, this is the heart,
uh-huh.
this is the bladder. And then he would take a piece of cane and put it into the bladder and then take it and blow it up, and it would remain, and it would be like a ball, per se, like a balloon on
uh-huh.
on a string. And then there was the cracklings of the cooking of the skin into cracklings, which would make crackling bread. My grandmother and my Aunt Mary, my mother then, would be grounding sausage in the kitchen and making crackling cornbread in the stove and molasses and fresh
You're making candy. Me hungry.
And, you know, and having these experiences and being able to watch all of that, and then knowing the bright embers of the fire under the wash pot, seeing that, and how we as kids, our bodies became silhouettes, you know, to that. And, you know, the men in their cover halls of working to take the hog and put him into the barrel and turn him and scrape him and all of that. Being able to see all of this and coming from a working community, this is what have motivated me and inspired me to document life as it is. The simplicity and the simple things in life, how we live from day to day, what we do on special holidays, family kinds of things and so forth. And this is what has been my mainstay in photography.
Now, the documentation of sort of everyday life, when did you really start that? Early 70s?
Early 70s. Mm-hmm. I became fascinated with Fourth Ward and the community, as I said, from the Model Cities Program, and being able to relate to a lot of what I saw in Houston. Reflected, Houston was so diversified. We talk now about Houston being a very diverse city. But as far as how one wanted to live, even from the time I first arrived in Houston, you know, it was very diverse then, because you can live in this neighborhood, you can live in a rural area, because such as Sunnyside, Acres Home, the Fourth Ward area, the Third Ward area, River Oaks, you know, the Galleria area, which then was a very rural area
mm-hmm.
at that particular time.
Mm-hmm.
And going way out there, you was way outside of the city. In my neighborhood growing up, there was a place called the Dewdrop Inn. And the Dewdrop was around the corner and up the hill from where we live, and that was a gravel road. And at night, during the summertime, when we was in bed, we would normally raise the window and to let a cool breeze come in. Because my brothers and I, we shared a bedroom. You could see the neon light just over the hill from the Dewdrop. And you could hear people talking. You could hear the honky-tonk music playing. And you could hear people back then, glass plaque mufflers on cars, were the things in the late 50s and just the early 60s that people was driving. And you could hear the music, you could hear women laughing and so forth, and we'd be laying in the bed, listening. You know, Houston was somewhat similar. You know, hearing that music about a dewdrop and a gravel road past the house, and people going down the road at night, and the cars running, and you hear them turning and going on and all this kind of stuff. And that commotion. Well, all of that I found in Houston. I found all of that, the livestock show and rodeo parade, the Black Cowboys parade, the TSU homecoming parade at the time where students actually built floats, and they would start from downtown and come down Main Street in front of the old Foley's building, which is no longer there now, and then the parade moved to Dowling Street and coming back to the campus, and how the people, the residents would come out, the little kids would march in front of the band and so forth, and from TSU having the band called the Mighty Few of TSU in 1969 to what we call the Ocean of Soul. And then going over to TSU and watching Mr. Provost start what was called the Juneteenth, the Ebony Tennis Class on Juneteenth, provided an opportunity for me to shoot all kinds of celebrities and people along this. But mind you, I still was doing my artwork. I was still throwing pots. I'm still doing my paintings and drawings. I end up doing a piece of weaving because we had to have a certain quantity of work to meet the requirement for graduation. So I was steady busy. But the Juneteenth, the Ebony Tennis Classic, opened up a new way of me having the experience of meeting people and hearing Mr. Provost talk about the kinds of people that you young men would meet. That you young guys should take off and go to Europe and have these experiences and photograph and so forth. And if I was a young man, I would still do this. But he was a tennis coach. TSU was playing Rice University at the time. He was going to my hometown in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, playing in the Big Black and Gold. And at the same time, he was traveling in between, making pitches at Southern University, at Wiley College, and all of the schools in the SWAC. He was servicing those schools and being on the road. And so these experiences from that is the kind of things that motivated me, you know, over the years.
Looking back on that, on all that time and when you were a student, if you could say one person really touched you more than any of the others, if you can say that, who would it be?
John Biggers.
Why?
Well, because John really pushed me. He took an interest personally in me. And to this day, I still don't understand why and how. But my first job in Houston was to clean up the painting room in the art department that he provided for me. And I guess I would say that because his enthusiasm of my asking to use the darkroom, which he had provided for the students there to use, and I knew of no other student who had ever actually used the darkroom. And there, and it was there for art majors to be able to produce their own portfolio. And for that reason, I would have to say that it was he, because he always challenged me. He always challenged all of his students, but I kept coming back. I started to visit in his studio. He started asking me to make photographs of certain pieces of sculpture for him. And he allowed me an opportunity to experiment until I was able to get it right as far as copying and photographing a painting. I had to learn how to set up lighting to photograph a painting that had a glare on it, was under glass and so forth and on. But then again, I went back to my references point. I went to Mr. Provost. I got information. Dr. Freeman provided us during the Model Cities program with cameras, with supplies to experiment. And you asked me the question, I would have to say John Biggers, but then again, I had a supporting cast. I have to go back to Nathaniel Sweets. I have to give credit to Alvin for putting the camera in my hand, because if that night, if he had not placed that camera in my hand, would I still be a photographer? That I don't know. If Mr. Provost hadn't opened up his studio for me to be able to experiment, and in the back, they had, he was a Navy man, and so he had two bunk beds, a top one and a lower one, in his studio between the dark rooms, that they would sleep up there when they had to retouch pictures. At the time, they would shoot pictures, come back, develop the film, come back and then actually print, come back and then paint the pictures, add, paint their faces, the tassel on the diploma and this, and then had to produce this and get it out. With him living on the outskirts of town at the time, they spent a lot of time at the studio. So during the down season, I was able to stay at the studio. I was there at night. I was able to work in the dark room and so forth and on. So this was very important to me because it provided me this opportunity to continue to hone my skills and my craft this particular way. So I have to give him credit. I have to give Dr. Freeman credit, as I said, for providing this kind of support as far as materials, even though we was working. Ray and I would shoot pictures on a Thursday night. On a Friday morning, when he came to the office, we would have a stack of pictures ready because we would stay in the building at night and develop. And that was that kind of enthusiasm during that time. And that has followed me all over the years.
That energy.
Oh, yes.
Early, to go on, what qualities, if you could say, within yourself, have been very important for your success and for your ongoing growth as a photographer?
Well, I think the mentoring process over the years, and as I think I had indicated, the help that I've had, it came from not only my mentors, John Biggers, Mr. Provost, Dr. Freeman, Carol Sims, who were very instrumental in the formative years of mm-hmm. me attending TSU. But there was also, you know, the students, Alan McEwen, Nathaniel Sweet, Ray Carrington. But beyond that, it's just the generality of people, the respect for people. I grew up in a community in Mississippi where we respected our elders. And even though people worked and people traveled, and during that time, a lot of people walked home in the evening, they rode the bus, and men in the evening that worked at various jobs would sometimes stop, have a couple of beers and so forth and on. And even though they may be coming down the street, staggering, either had one or too many, they would say, "Hey, aren't you boys, aren't you early hunting all those boys?" We would say, "Yes, sir. Y'all get out these streets and stop throwing these rocks." And hey, we would not. Then people back then, they could actually spank you if they saw you doing something that wasn't correct. Then they come home, tell your parents, and you end
and
up
you get
getting
another,
another whipping. So I'm saying that in general is that I've always had respect for an individual, no matter who they were. I never feel sorry for any of my subjects, but there is this ultimate respect for however they exist because each one of them gives to me. So I would have to say that over the years, the respect for people and my love just for human nature and the universality of man, wherever I've been able to travel, I've met people, and in every community, there are so many similarities that we can find that we have had experiences with, that we are going to continue to have experiences with, and that is so wonderful.
You know, I think it's that fundamental respect that you're talking about that enhances your ability to capture the dignity of every person that's inherent, no matter the circumstances, no matter the subject, no matter where they are. But there's a dignity, I think, that comes through your photographs with your subjects.
Thank you. You know, I feel that it's a rush and it's an excitement when you see the image of the picture. And there is something that sends off the signal that this is the moment to snap or to make the picture. And that moment is a very sacred, very special kind of excitement. It's, you know, it's hard to explain. It's a creation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're creating, you're freezing a moment in time, but you're having to work with the subject. And you can't make the picture unless you put yourself in the face of the subject. But yet and still, the subject don't have to communicate with you. You don't have to speak to it. But there is this magical timing that you and that subject comes into orbit. The timing of the magical things of the universe all comes into play, that it provides you the opportunity to capture something that someone else can enjoy. That subject contributes to society in such a way without even truly knowing that the image that he provided to the photographer at that precise moment can have impact as to how someone else thinks or feel, or it influences them a certain way, or having a certain amount of compassion. To me, that's power. And that's the power, that is something that is given to you by God, and it is the result of hard work and perseverance, and it's something that is sacred, and something that you don't abuse and you don't misuse.
Mm-hmm.
And this is basically my philosophy as to I'm charged to do that. And that is my responsibility. And I have to live up to that. To do less than that is not, you know, putting forth my best effort. My father always would say, if he was sick, and there were several times that he had to go into the hospital for an operation or to leave and to go out of town, and he would always say, hey, look, I have to leave. I'm putting you in charge. And he said, all I ask for you to do is to do your best. And I said, yes, sir, I'll do my best. And this is what I try to do each and every day, is to do my best.